I guess the first thing I'd better say is I'm really chagrined to be up here and rather uncomfortable because this thing could have been prevented if I'd used a little more due diligence. But I can also assure you that in my own mind, that notice of appeal was filed. I can give you all kinds of reasons. Don't offer those as excuses, but I had in my hands, or on my computer screen at least, the filing of the fee. The document was uploaded through the whole thing. Where did it break down? I'm not sure. I mean, I just cannot go back with an independent memory of it.
But the real problem for you is that it didn't come to your attention or whatever until long past the other 30 other deadline.
Judge, you're exactly 100% right. I can't argue with that a bit. In defense, I would say, again, when I filed it, it did go into the system. It had to, otherwise couldn't pay the filing fee. Whether or not...
When you say it, do you mean the filing fee or the notice?
The notice of appeal had to be uploaded before you got to the filing fee. But it never made it to the CMECF. It never made it to the court. It was uploaded on my computer. I looked at it. Yes, fine. Next. Filing fee, credit card, all that. And then at some point, something happened. I don't know if I hit cancel instead of next. I mean, that's a possibility. I'm not a newbie at this. I know how to file the things, but I mean, is it possible I made a human mistake? Sure. Is it possible there was an internet thing? We were having internet fluctuations at that time. And part of the problem, you know, is you remember the time frame. This is pandemic 101, 102, coming back and forth. We were shifting from office to home to office to home. In Louisiana, we had several cases, several times when there was lockdown, several times they weren't. I don't know if I did it. I don't know if it was a glitch with the system in the court CMECF system. And, you know, Judge Hertling did say, we don't know what happened. And that's actually true. I just don't know.
The rules of the Court of Federal Claims, and I'm looking at Appendix E of the rules, which you may be familiar with, says that a filing is not complete until the notification comes back from the court that the filing has been made.
Yes, sir.
And that never happened in this case, I take it, at the time.
It never happened. Again, the problem is sometimes those things come back, they go to spam folders, and sometimes you just miss them. Now, what was in my case, or in my head at that time, was if you remember, Lafayette Square was kind of under siege, and I had filed a number of other things, as learned counsel pointed out, on behalf of Military Veterans Advocacy and others, including a couple of extraordinary writs. We were having problems, you know, getting the docketing sheet back. And I remember calling up and talking to the clerk's office, and they said, look, we're just really behind. Things are happening. It's hard to come to work. You know, and because of both
I'm a little surprised because I was here every day and we were operating quite efficiently.
I can only tell you what they told me, Judge.
But how did you ultimately at some point the light bulb went on and you realized there was a problem, right? You ended up filing. You were just filing.
Well, actually, what keyed me to it is I had gotten a docketing notice from this court. And that's what I couldn't figure out. And, you know, it was, again, just a lot of things, a lot of balls in the air. I looked at it, and I said, I got to go check on that. And then something else would happen.
Well, you got a problem, right? I mean, you realize that you have a problem here, and the rules are the rules, and, you know, sometimes things happen, and they appear not to be fair. But how do you get through the hurdles that are articulated in Judge Hertling's opinion?
Well, I think the big thing is the constructive filing doctrine is...
constructive filing meaning what? What was constructive? Because you filed the fee?
Well, not only that, but because I actually attached the notice of appeal. You know, it comes to the point where you have to go browse and upload. You do that, and then you pay the filing fee. On a complaint, or actually in district court, usually what will happen is you'll get a little thing on there that says, once you pay the filing fee, you have to complete it. And if you don't complete it, you get a gig. Never got a gig. I just assumed, and of course, you know, assuming is never a good thing, but I just assumed it went through until finally it was just dawning on me that we weren't getting a docketing
Whatever happened to the $505 filing fee?
Well, they haven't refunded it, Judge, so and I'm not asking for it at this point. Yeah. But
that was taken out of the account?
Oh yeah, yes sir. I paid that for the by credit card.
But it was taken out immediately?
Yes. Oh, and that's okay. When I got the receipt under it from pay.gov.
I see.
So but what are the rules that you're advocating? If you're advocating this was a constructive filing, how do we define that? I mean, yours is a very peculiar and different example, perhaps, but how do we put any limits on that? What are the limits?
Well, I don't know if you can put in a stupidity exception, because I could probably qualify for that on this case. And believe me, if you all had a dumb move of the year award, I'd have to nominate myself, because
you'd have a lot of competition.
I'm not sure on this one, Judge. Appreciate it.
So to follow up, I'm having the same question that Judge Prost does, is what theory do you think is the most attractive theory for you, that the notice of the payment was itself a constructive notice of appeal, or B, that what you did constitutes, that making an effort to file the notice of appeal constitutes a notice, or what?
I think it's all of the above. If it was just a matter of pay the filing fee and then come back and make a separate CMECF transaction, I'd say that the constructive filing would not apply.
So the paying the filing fee itself wouldn't be enough?
No, sir.
Okay.
But the whole process, of going through, uploading it, the only thing I can figure out, Judge, is if it was my failure, and it very well may have been, is everything was done until the next key, the last thing to put it up, and, I don't know. I don't know if I hit cancel. I don't know if my internet dropped. I don't know if the court's internet dropped. I honestly don't know. I wish I did. Client, however, is a very understanding sort, which I appreciate. But any harm or any negligence on the part, in this case, is mine, not his. And one of the things I think about the constructive filing doctrine is it does allow for taking care of dumb moves by attorneys and by anybody else.
Is there any case under Section 2107, which is the section that governs the filing, that's the section that's been held to be mandatory and jurisdictional, but is there any case, to your knowledge, in which facts akin to yours, let's say, have been held to be sufficient for a constructive filing?
Not 2107 per se, but then the jurisdictional statute, the statute, we don't think it's jurisdictional, is 2555. And there is nothing under that. 2255.
Right.
You're right, Judge. Thank you. But
right, but the statute 2107, I think, applies to all courts of appeals, and 2522 just says, appeals from the Court of Federal Claims, where we follow the same process.
But there are some issues, some cases, especially in the veterans arena, where constructive filing has come into place. The case of...
Right, but that those aren't covered by 2107, I don't think. Right?
Well...
And they're not covered by 2522.
They're not by 2522.
Right.
I don't believe that statute, and I read it again this morning, actually incorporates 2107. The court found that it did, okay, but the plain language of the statute, which is what we have to go to, does not mention
but 2107. But 2107 applies to all appeals to courts of appeals from judgments and orders. And why doesn't that include appeals from the Court of Federal Claims to this court?
Well, I think for a couple reasons. First off, there's a separate statute. If 2522
right.
didn't exist, I'd say that argument would be right on. But it does exist, just like 7266 exists for the veterans courts. So I think if Congress has set up a separate scheme Plus, we're dealing with Article I courts, where the 2107 normally deals with Article III courts at the district level. I understand y'all are Article III court. I wasn't trying to denigrate
you. No, I understand.
But I think those two things are
okay.
Are very unique. Your Honors, I'm into my rebuttal time.
Why don't we hear from the other side, and we'll be
thank you so much. And again, my apologies. I can't believe I screwed this up.
Morning. Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. This case is unfortunate, and I take no pleasure in the argument, but the Court must affirm the trial court's post-judgment order because Mr. Summers did not appeal and did not move to extend the time to appeal within the time limits set forth in Section 2107. This Court's precedents are crystal clear. Time and again, in cases like Mirandola and Saffarelli, this Court has held that the statutory time limits are jurisdictional.
You've started off on the same point that your opposing counsel ended with, so if we can move to that. Do you think that 2107 governs this case, or 2522, or both?
It's both, Your Honor. Mirandola and Saffarelli were both appeals from the Court of Federal Claims, and the way the statutes interoperate is 2107 applies to all appeals from judgments from district courts. That's 2107.
From district courts?
Yes, that's the language of the rule. And then 2522 provides that appeals from the Court of Federal Claims proceed in the same manner as appeals from district courts.
Maybe I'm missing it, but I don't see any reference to district courts. Is there in 2107? 2107A, except as otherwise provided in this section, no appeal should bring any judgment, order, or decree in an action, suit, or proceeding of a civil nature before a court of appeals for review unless a notice of appeal is filed within 30 days.
Indeed, Your Honor. The reference to the district court that I was thinking of is in 2107C.
Right, and that's not implicated here, right?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
That isn't what governs the 30, or in this case, 60-day rule, right?
That's right. 2107C
just deals with
the extension for
right.
good cause. That's right.
But,
so arguably, 2107 would apply to any civil appeal, as Your Honor indicated. But lest there be any doubt, 2522 specifically says.
But our precedent, the precedent we've been talking about here, Saffarelli and
Mirandola,
they didn't reference 2522 at all, right?
The only reason they did not, and they certainly could have, if I may, Your Honor, last month the court decided Peretz, which did specifically reference 2107 and 2522.
Is that a presidential opinion?
To my knowledge, I believe it's non-presidential, Your Honor.
Right. We've had a lot of non-presidential opinions, but of course they're non-presidential. So let's return. I'm interested in the government's position with respect to the role played by 2522. Are you saying, in effect, either that without 2522, this rule would not apply to the Court of Federal Claims, or are you saying that 2522, with respect to the 60-day requirement, is superfluous, given the existence of 2107?
Well, presumably Congress did not intend to pass a superfluous statute, but whether you look at 2107A or that provision in conjunction with 2522...
Well, I guess I'm stepping back a step. I'm interested in what the government's position is with respect to this question. Is 2107 enough, or is 2522 essential to establish the rule that applies to Court of Federal Claims appeals?
I think the argument could be made that 2107, A, standing alone is sufficient.
Right, but I'm curious about the government's position.
We have not made that argument because we didn't think we needed it in this case, and that's not something I've studied at length.
Okay.
We can say, you're right, Congress, we would never suggest they do anything superfluous. But on the other hand, we do talk about belts and suspenders and sort of fix-its for those. So I think your friend makes the argument, we got Bowles, and that concerns 2107, but not necessarily 2522. So if you're relying on 2522, what do you make of that argument?
Well, it's a distinction without a difference, Your Honor, because 2522 specifically says that any appeal from the Court of Federal Claims will proceed in the same manner and at the same time as an appeal from a district court. So there's no daylight between the law as it pertains to appeals from district courts and appeals from the Court of Federal Claims.
I know I'm going to regret asking this question, but is there any legislative history for 2522 suggesting why anyone thought it was necessary?
We have not studied that question, Your Honor, so I don't know.
I would
respectfully submit, Your Honor, that the plain language of the statute is crystal clear. In the same time, in the same manner as a district court appeal, there's no daylight.
It actually says it has to be filing a notice of appeal with the clerk of the Court of the Federal Claims within the time and in the manner prescribed for appeals to the United States Court of Appeals for the United States District Courts, right?
Yes, indeed.
That language is precise.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And I was paraphrasing, but indeed, that's the language of the statute.
Mr. Wells, that's right, argued that the appeals from the Veterans Court, the Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims, are governed by a different statute, and the rules are therefore different. Does that suggest that maybe 2107 does not cover Court of Federal Claims appeals? Because you could, I suppose, say that the appeals coming from a judgment of the Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is an appeal from a judgment or order in a civil action? Or would you say that's not a civil action?
Those provisions are inapplicable.
I understand they're inapplicable. Trying to go with this question is to try to see mm-hmm. if the status of the statute that governs veterans claims tells us something about the status of the statute governing appeals from the Court of Federal Claims,
I understand your question, Your Honor. It doesn't. Mr. Summers invokes the pro-veteran canon from veterans' appeals in this case. Mr. Summers is a veteran, and we thank him for his service, but this appeal does not involve any veteran statute, and he has not identified any statutory ambiguity. So the canons of construction do not come into play. Instead, the resolution of this appeal requires a straightforward application of the time limits in the statute under this court's well-established precedent.
What about the question of whether there was an effective filing of the notice through either the paying of the fee, which was apparently acknowledged, the cash, the check, so that's a pretty good indication of acknowledgement, any of the other steps taken by Mr. Wells in this case?
Right. So Mr. Summers attempted to file the notice of appeal and did pay the filing fee, but he didn't actually file the notice of appeal.
Right.
Until you reach that last step in the filing process, the document never leaves your computer. This is the electronic equivalent of leaving a notice of appeal on the sidewalk outside of the courthouse.
How do we know that? We have the only thing we know is that there wasn't a receipt sent back. But that doesn't necessarily tell us, does it, that there was nothing received by the court. The court's computers, the functionality that produces the receipt may have been ineffective at that point, or some glitch may have occurred, right?
Well, no. We do know that it never reached the court, because the court's rules say that a document is not electronically docketed until that last step.
Right. As a matter of law, in a sense, that the court has defined a filing as requiring that last step, mm-hmm. I agree with you. But that doesn't mean that as a matter of fact that the submission didn't reach the court, does it?
Okay. Well, let's talk about as a matter of fact.
Yeah.
There was no showing that there was any error by court personnel or court processes in this case. There's been a showing that the appellant has no idea how it happened. I can tell Your Honor that I specifically asked the ECF clerk of the Court of Federal Claims this very question, because I didn't want to make an argument before Your Honors if I wasn't absolutely confident that I was making the correct argument. And there is no, the document does not leave your computer until that final step. If you abort the filing at any point before that final step, it never leaves your computer, it never is received by the courthouse, and there could be no showing that the court ever received this notice of appeal during the time to appeal. And we understand that sometimes things happen.
Can I make sure I understand your answer? You're saying not only was there no notice of appeal, there was nothing that was sent to the court other than that a payment was made.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. And Mr. Wells has conceded before Your Honors here that the payment of the filing fee standing alone is not sufficient. What Mr. Summers is asking this court to do is to essentially excuse the filing requirement altogether under the guise of a constructive filing doctrine. But it's a far different thing to waive a defect in a filing under a constructive filing theory than to waive the filing requirement altogether. That's an equitable exception to the filing requirement for inadvertence or negligence or what have you that is foreclosed by the Supreme Court's decision in Bowles, by this court's decisions in Mirandola and Soffarelli. The statutory requirement of the timely filing is jurisdictional. There can be no equitable exceptions.
Suppose the following happened. Suppose that Mr. Wells, after having noticed that there wasn't, immediately noticed that there wasn't a receipt sent back, had called the clerk's office and had gotten in touch with someone in the clerk's office of the Court of Federal Claims and had said, I didn't get a receipt. And the clerk erroneously said, oh, well, if you sent it, we must have gotten it. And from time to time, we have a problem with our system. And I believe, again, erroneously, I believe that you did send it. And so you're okay. Would that be constructive filing in your view?
It can't be, Your Honor, because that's the old theory that was embraced by the Thompson and Harris truck lines Supreme Court cases from back in the 50s or whenever, that Bowles overruled. Those cases allowed for courts to deem notices of appeal timely filed under what were considered unique circumstances, where a party performed an act improperly, but they were relying on some specific assurance from a judicial officer that they gave them comfort that they had done it correctly, even though they hadn't.
Do you think that Bowles overruled Houston against Lack?
No, that's a different situation, Your Honor, and that's an exception that deals with prisoners, which is inapplicable here. That's also captured in one of the provisions of, I believe, Section 4, Rule 4 of the Federal Rules of Appellate Procedure has an exception along those lines as well for prisoners. But
did that exception exist before Houston against Lack?
I'm not sure, Your Honor,
isn't there some tension between your position and your characterization of Bowles and Houston against Lack?
None at all, Your Honor, because, of course, Bowles came later.
It did.
And the rules are crystal clear under precedence. Now, I would also just, before my time expires, I just want to add that this is not a harsh result. There is built into the statute a safe harbor where if something goes wrong, you know, we understand things happen sometimes, and a party has 30 days to recognize their error and go to the trial court and seek an extension of time. Even a modicum of diligence would have resulted in a timely filing to motion to extend the appeal deadline. And almost certainly, we would not be here today arguing about these technicalities. But under the court's precedence and the clear statutory command, the court should affirm. Thank you.
Thank you.
Your Honors, if I may, a couple of quick points. The Marion Doe and the Soffaroni cases involved situations where nothing was filed. Okay, no fee, no documents, so on and so forth. Our position is we have put them into the system. We still don't know why it didn't get there, but it was initially put into the system with the filing fee. We got an acknowledgement on the filing fee.
There are cases in which the filing fee was paid, but no notice of appeal was filed, and the courts, I think, uniformly have said that's not good enough.
That's correct, but in the issue we're looking at as far as constructive filing, is we thought it was filed, and you know we had some evidence to believe it was filed, it wasn't just a matter of sending
filing
fee.
Then you have the 30 days to figure it out.
Judge.
And to confirm that. I mean, that's, as your friend suggests, this isn't just a hard and fast, you missed your chance.
I understand.
So even on kind of equitable principles, this is a little different than your.
I understand, but again, I'd ask you to remember the times. Look, I just had a case of the Court of Federal Claims where I filed a complaint, didn't get the comeback, believe me, I was jumping all over them. And sure enough, it eventually came through. Now, I guess I can say I've learned from this mistake. But all I can tell you is we made the attempt to file. If the filing was defective, and apparently it was defective through whatever reason, okay, we think we still come in under the constructive filing. The problem is, Your Honors, if I messed up, is it fair to hold my client responsible for my mistake? I mean, you can chew me out, you can fine me, sanction me. I mean, I can't argue on any of that. But my client was the innocent party here.
Well, the problem is that principle obviously cannot be applied because what would that do to us? I mean, if it's the lawyer's fault, there's maybe a mechanism in which that is resolved, but it can't be by letting...
But in the brief, we did show where that has happened. And again, it's mostly in the veterans'
arena,
which is analogous.
Speaking of that, you mentioned the veterans' canon.
Yes, ma'am.
You're not arguing that veterans' canon, which has been applied in the veterans' context, would have some applicability in this instance.
I certainly am arguing that,
you
Your
are?
Honor.
Yeah.
If you go back to the original Boone versus Leitner, that was not a Title 38 case, that was a Title 50 case under the Service Members Civil Relief Act. There's nothing in that canon that I've seen over the decisions from Boone, Henderson, or whatever, or Federal Circuit decisions, which were limited just to veterans' benefits, Title 38 veterans' benefits case. Arguably, since we're talking about some paying allowances here, those are benefits. And as counsel conceded, Mr. Summers is a veteran. If it would apply in the Service Members Civil Relief Act, I'll learn to say that as soon as I learn how to say, the statute. If it would apply in that arena, why wouldn't it apply here? And if you do apply that, You have to take any ambiguity, and we can submit that there is ambiguity because 2107 is not incorporated. The other thing, if you look at Bowles, now Bowles dealt with 2107, okay? It didn't deal with 2552. I'm going to get it yet, Judge Bryson. I'm trainable, believe it or not. Bowles didn't apply to that. And the other thing is, let's look back to the question, is it jurisdictional? Again, going to Irwin, which was another veterans case, I agree, but it didn't seem to, the Supreme Court didn't seem to limit it to just to veterans.
So what principle would you apply that 2522, when the underlying case before the Court of Federal Claims deals with anything related to a veteran receiving any amount of money from the government, then Bowles doesn't apply? Is that the rule you're advocating here?
No, I'm saying that Bowles doesn't apply because statutory language doesn't set up a very clear incorporation or anything to make it look like it's jurisdictional. It's just not jurisdictional. There's nothing in statute that says
So you're saying yes, that your rule would be any time a veteran is implicated in terms of any claim before the Court of Veterans Claim, the Court of Federal Claims, then Bowles doesn't apply.
Your Honor, I think that's true from
because
that.
Because of the Veterans Canon?
Not just because of the Veterans Canon. The Veterans Canon just puts additional support for it, but just because of the plain language of the statute. Under Irwin.
I'm sure I understand. Are you saying 2522 because it doesn't expressly talk about 2107? There is no time limit, so therefore there's no
Judge, I understand how you could believe that. That's not what I'm saying.
Okay.
What I'm saying is it makes it possible for waiver. I've still got to come up under the constructive filing doctrine and show that I meet that doctrine because there was some different circumstances, because exigent circumstances, because I did do some due diligence, and because there was a connection.
So if I could follow up on
yes,
Judge Stoll's
point. I'm sorry,
go ahead. Finish your point.
I'm sorry.
Please, go ahead.
No, I was finished. I'm sorry. I was just turning to answer your question while I was still talking.
All right. So just to be sure I understand, and this is a follow-up to Judge Stoll's question, are you suggesting that a different rule applies under 2522 than would be the case if we were under 2107?
Yes, sir, because of Bowles sitting out there on 2107. But if you remember Judge Souter's dissent, it was a matter of, you know, they didn't really address the equitable estoppel issue as well. So, you know, it was a very close decision. I'm not sure exactly where things fall on it, but I can tell you that it does not fall to 2522. I got that one right, Your Honor. Thank you so much. Sorry I went over time. And judges, nobody feels worse about this than I do.
Thank you. I thank both sides in the cases submitted.